listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Today's show is a salute to the sleuth and their sidekick. After all, what is Sherlock without Watson? Poirot without Hastings? Dashiell Hammett's Nick Charles without Nora? Friends, confidants, flatmates, or mates? The sidekick is often the catalyst necessary for our hero to solve the puzzle. As Watson mused, Holmes was a man of habits, and I had become one of them, a comrade, a whetstone for his mind. My guest today, David Baldacci, is, once again, at the top of the mystery game and at the top of the bestseller list. We'll get the backstory on his new title, Escape, and some insights on how he keeps churning out the hits. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. You can leave the army, but the army doesn't leave you. Not always, not completely. These are the thoughts of one Jack Reacher, a man we know quite well, and who doesn't seem to know how to stay out of trouble's way. Lee Child begins personal, book 19 in the series, with a bang. Someone has taken a shot at the President of France in the City of Light. The bullet was American. The distance between the gunman and the target was exceptional. How many snipers can shoot from 3/4 of a mile with total confidence? Very few. But John Cott, an American marksman gone bad, is one of them. And after 15 years in prison, he's out, unaccounted for, and likely drawing a bead on a G8 summit packed with enough world leaders to tempt any assassin. If anyone can stop Cott, it's the man who beat him before, Reacher. And though he'd rather work alone, Reacher is teamed with Casey Nice, a rookie analyst who keeps her cool with Zoloft. But the pair is facing a rough road, full of mobsters, Serbian thugs, close calls, double crosses, and no backup if they're caught. Dick Hill narrates.
Seattle was dry when I got out of the bus, and warm, and wired, in the sense that coffee was being consumed in prodigious quantities, which made it my kind of town, and in the sense that Wi-Fi hotspots and handheld devices were everywhere, which didn't, and which made old-fashioned street-corner payphones hard to find. But there was one down by the fish market, so I stood in the salt breeze and the smell of the sea, and I dialed the toll-free number at the Pentagon. Not a number you'll find in the phone book. A number learned by heart long ago. A special line. For emergencies only. You don't always have a quarter in your pocket. The operator answered, and I asked for Shoemaker, and I got transferred, maybe elsewhere in the building, or the country, or the world. And after a bunch of clicks and hisses and some long minutes of dead air, Shoemaker came on the line and said, "Yes?" "This is Jack Reacher," I said. "Where are you?" "Don't you have all kinds of automatic machines to tell you that?" "Yes," he said. "You're in Seattle on a payphone down by the fish market. But we prefer it when people volunteer the information themselves. We find that makes the subsequent conversation go better, because they're already cooperating. They're invested." "In what?" "In the conversation." "Are we having a conversation?" "Not really." "What do you see directly ahead?" I looked. "A street," I said. "Left?" "Places to buy fish." "Right?" "A coffee shop across the light." "Name?" I told him. He said, "Go in there and wait." "For what?" "For about 30 minutes, he said, and hung up. No one really knows why coffee is such a big deal in Seattle. It's a port, so maybe it made sense to roast it close to where it was landed and then to sell it close to where it was roasted, which created a market, which brought other operators in, the same way the automakers all ended up in Detroit. And maybe the water is right, or the elevation, or the temperature, or the humidity. But whatever, the result is a coffee shop on every block, and a four-figure annual tab for a serious enthusiast. The shop across the light from the payphone was representative. It had maroon paint and exposed brick and scarred wood, and a chalkboard menu about 90% full of things that don't really belong in coffee, like dairy products of various types and temperatures, and weird nut-based flavorings, and many other assorted pollutants.
We've just heard Personal by Lee Child. David Baldacci published his first novel, Absolute Power, in 1996. A major motion picture adaptation followed, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood. Since then, David has published 28 best-selling novels, several of which have also been adapted for film and TV. A lifelong Virginian, David attended Virginia Commonwealth University. After graduating from the UVA Law School, he began his law practice in Washington, D.C. David and his wife Michelle established the Wish You Well Foundation to support family and adult literacy by fostering and promoting the development and expansion of literacy and educational programs. In 2008, the foundation partnered with Feeding America to launch Feeding Body and Mind, a program to address the connection between literacy, poverty, and hunger. Today we'll speak with David about his new title in his John Puller series, The Escape. Welcome, David. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you.
The action in The Escape starts right on page one. Can you give us a brief overview of the story?
Robert Puller is in DB, the disciplinary barracks. It's like the most maximum secure military prison in the country. He's there for national security crimes, and he escapes from DB, which is inescapable, and does so in a pretty unique way. It takes advantage of an opportunity that presents itself. His brother is John Puller, who is an Army criminal investigator, and John Puller has been in a couple of previous books, Zero Day and The Forgotten, and he is brought in because he knows his brother so well, and brought in to try to hunt him down, so it's sort of brother against brother in this novel.
Right. Well, John's brother Robert is a genius in next-generation nuclear weaponry. How much research did you have to do to write it so convincingly?
Yeah, I did. I always do a lot of research for the books. When you're dealing with something as complicated as nuclear weapons, you really have to leave most of it out, otherwise you're going to lose your audience. So that and the intelligence field with all the criminal databases and hacking and all the other things, I really touched on all of it as deeply as I could without turning a novel into a textbook. The key with doing research for a novel like this is you leave 99% of it out, and you'll use a phrase here, a sentence there, a bit of a description in a paragraph here or there, just to give people the real flavor and a veneer of authenticity, and then move on with the story.
I wanted to ask you, you wrote this, there are nearly 1,300 government organizations and 2,000 private companies in over 10,000 locations spread across the country, employing close to 1 million people, all holding top secret clearances or higher. Is that for real?
Oh, yeah, that's totally for real. It's, if Walmart were an intelligence agency, I guess that's what they would be. People they employ, for the most part. It's one of the biggest employers in the country, and it's taken very seriously by lots of big players, not just government, but the major players in this, the Raytheons of the world and the Northrop Grummans and the Lockheed Martins, Boeing. They're huge players, huge, multi-billion dollar companies. And there's a lot of money to be had here. It's intensely competitive, and people take it very seriously, particularly after 9/11.
What about the Cyber Command? How did you get that information?
Yeah, I know a lot of people in the military, and so I interviewed a bunch of them for this novel to get as much as information as I could to make the novel, feel very authentic. It wasn't like I was ever asking for any classified information. These agencies are public for the most part, and what they do for the most part is public, but talking to people and seeing how they do their jobs, how things actually work out in the field, is very different from the just sort of Wikipediaing stuff, Googling something. Anybody can do that, but going out and interviewing people who actually do it, I think really separates this story from a story where somebody just Googled it.
Right. I got to be a big fan of Veronica Knox. Can you introduce us and talk about your process for developing an important secondary character?
Yeah, Veronica was quite the conundrum. She's an enigma in this book. And John Puller, his judgment kept changing on her. You know, was she legitimate? Was she a friend? Was she an enemy? Was she an ally? Was she a foe? And, you know, he came to where he wasn't able to really trust his judgment about her because she's very good at what she does. She's in the intelligence field. She has really great cover. She has a set of skills that most people would look on and say, gee, that's really, you know, bad for a human being to do that, but really it's the skill set she needs to survive in the world that she's chosen to work in. And they really are very much oil and water throughout the course of this book, but I love the dynamic of two very different characters having to come together to reach a common goal, but doing it in far different ways.
Zero Day was the first John Puller novel. When you were writing it, did you know it would become a series, and were future adventures already formulating in your mind?
I had foreshadowed the payoff in The Escape that was Robert Puller's imprisonment. You know, why was he there? What had he done? Was he actually guilty? And was he going to be in prison the rest of his life? So that was really set up very early in Zero Day. I think the first scene you meet John Puller, he's going to visit Robert Puller in prison. So my hope was that this would become a series as I was writing that first novel, and it turned out to be the case. And I'd forgotten Robert Puller was in that for a little bit. Long distance, obviously, he was still in prison. But I knew the escape, obviously, and you can tell from the title, this was going to be the payoff to that foreshadowing of Robert Puller's story in Zero Day.
We're speaking with David Baldacci on The Book Report. Can you talk a little bit about Face Off, your involvement, and the finished product?
Yeah, that was cool. I mean, I've been a member of the International Thriller Writers Organization for a long time, one of the founding members. And from time to time, we do these anthologies where we have our members come together to write short stories and do anthologies, and those books are then sold, and those funds go to run the organization. And this one was a little bit different in that we wanted a bunch of our members, writers, to take their iconic, you know, key series characters, like Harry Bosch and Michael Connelly, and put them into stories that they co-wrote with another thriller writer. So you might have Joseph Fender and Lee Child matched up, and Michael Connelly and another writer matched up with their characters in that story doing something together. Never been done before. That's why where the title Face Off came. It's like these two characters were facing off in each short story. So it was really cool, something we had never done before. I got to edit it, which was an easy job for me. Obviously, these people are terrific writers. I didn't have a whole lot of work to do, but it was great publicizing it. I did an audio introduction for the audiobook version of it and wrote the introduction for the hardcover, and just a lot of fun. People really loved it. It sold incredibly well, and just something you don't see every day.
Right, and hopefully will there be another edition, like maybe one a year or one every other year?
Oh, we'll continue to do those, absolutely. It was so popular that I don't think there's any way we can't not do another one.
You also write for young adults. Tell us about that.
Yeah, years ago when my kids were small, I wrote the Freddy and the French Fries series. It was really young kids, illustrated books. Last March, The Finisher came out, which is my young adult fantasy that I spent 5 years writing. And it was sort of, you know, kind of like my Lord of the Rings and Hunger Games and Harry Potter rolled into one. And Scholastic published that in March. I actually sold that book to Scholastic under a pseudonym. They didn't even know it was me, because I wanted them to buy the book for the book, not because of the name. And hit number one, it sold incredibly well, won a number of awards, and I just recently finished the sequel to that. It'll be out next fall, and I'm having a blast doing it.
Do you work on more than one book simultaneously?
Yeah, I just finished two books. One was the spring thriller that'll come out in 2015, and then the other was a sequel to The Finisher, and I wrote both of those books in parallel. I would spend half the day on one and half the day on the other.
Hmm. In your writing life, do you have any long-term goals that you're working towards?
It's a long-term, short-term goal. It's just what's the next story.
Okay. Tell us a little about the Wish You Well Foundation.
My wife and I started it 15 years ago and pumped a lot of money into it. Illiteracy is a huge problem in this country. Half the adult population reads the two lowest levels of literacy. We have 1 million high school dropouts a year. Socioeconomically, they're doomed. And when I first started my career, I did a lot of events sponsored by libraries and Friends of the Library and literacy organizations, so I got really steeped in that area. So we fund literacy programs across this country, and we have a board of directors. We get probably 5,000 grant applications a year. We fund as many as we can. We funded programs virtually all 50 states and counting. We also have a Feeding Body and Mind program where I go on book tour. I send boxes ahead. My fans fill the boxes up with lots of different types of books, and those books are shipped to local area food banks. So people coming in to seek food assistance often have low reading skill, and that's why they're impoverished. Getting books in the hands of those people, into their homes, into their kids' hands, is a way to break that cycle of poverty and that cycle of illiteracy. And over the last 4 years, we've collected and shipped out over 1 million books.
Wow.
And continue to do so.
That's amazing. Congratulations. Do you have any final thoughts about The Escape?
Yeah, it's, John Polar rocks in this one, and there's not a lot of downtime. And when I go back and reread this book, and there's just a lot packed into it, as my editor told me, there's enough in there for 3 books. But I just wanted this book to be, a great finale to this question of Robert Puller that I had opened up in the very first book, and wanted to make sure that I put everything into it I possibly could.
Well, you've succeeded brilliantly. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Bye. And now let's listen to a sampling of The Escape, performed by Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy.
It was quiet now. But a violent storm front that had been on the radar for a while was howling in from the north. Another system that had sprung up in Texas was barreling toward the Midwest like a brakeless freight train. It would soon meet its northern counterpart, with devastating results. The entire area was already hunkering down in anticipation. When the two rampaging fronts met 3 hours later, the result was a storm of shattering proportions, with jagged lightning slicing sideways across the sky, rain bucketing down, and winds that seemed to have no limit to their strength or reach. The power lines went first, snapped like string by tumbling trees. Then down came the phone lines. After that, more trees toppled, blocking roads. The nearby Kansas City International Airport had been shut down ahead of time. All planes empty and the terminal full of travelers riding out the storm and quietly thanking God they were on the ground instead of up in that maelstrom. Inside the DB, the guards made their rounds or sipped their coffees in the break room or talked in low whispers, exchanging scuttlebutt of no importance just to get through their shifts. No one thought anything of the storm outside since they were safely inside a fortress of brick and steel. They were like an aircraft carrier confronted by gale force winds and heavy seas. It might not be pleasant, but they would easily ride it out. Even when the regular power failed as both transformers at a nearby substation blew up, plunging the prison into momentary darkness, no one was overly concerned. The massive backup generator automatically kicked on, and that machine was inside a bombproof installation with its own underground power source of natural gas that would never run out of juice. This secondary system came on so fast that the short lapse did nothing more than cause jittery fluorescence and a few pops on surveillance cameras and computer monitors. Guards finished their coffees and moved on to other gossip, while others slowly made their way down halls and around corners and in and out of pods, making sure all was well in the world of the DB. What finally got everyone's attention was the total silence that came when the foolproof generator with the endless supply of energy and the bomb-proof installation made a noise like a giant with whooping cough, and then simply died. All the lights, cameras, and consoles instantly went out, although some of the surveillance cameras had battery backups and thus remained on. And then the quiet was replaced with urgent cries and the sounds of men running. Communication radios crackled and popped. Flashlights were snatched from holders on leather belts and powered up, but they provided only meager illumination. And then the unthinkable occurred. All the automatic cell doors unlocked. This was not supposed to happen. The system was built such that whenever the power failed, the doors automatically locked. Not so good for prisoners if the power failure was due to, say, a fire, but that's the way it was, or the way it was supposed to be. However, now the guards were hearing the clicks of cell doors opening all over the prison, and hundreds of prisoners were emerging into the hallways. There were no guns allowed in the DB. Thus, the guards had only their authority, wits, training, ability to read prisoners' moods, and heavy batons to keep order. And now those batons were gripped in hands that were becoming increasingly sweaty. There were SOPs, or standard operating procedures, for such an eventuality, because the military had procedures for every eventuality. The Army typically had two backups for all critical items. At the DB, the natural gas backup generator was considered a fail-safe. However, now, it had failed. Now it fell to the guards to maintain complete order. They were the last line of defense. The first goal was to secure all prisoners. The secondary goal was to secure all prisoners. Anything else would be deemed an unacceptable failure by any military standard. Careers, and along with them stars and bars, would fall off like parched needles from a Christmas tree still up in late January.
We've just heard The Escape by David Baldacci. And speaking of dynamic duos, let's listen to a sampling of Face Off, edited by David Baldacci. The book includes stories by 23 of the most critically acclaimed thriller writers. In this 11-story anthology, the authors, including Dennis Lehane and Michael Connelly, Preston and Child, and Jeffrey Deaver, have paired their series characters, like Harry Bosch, Jack Reacher, and Lincoln Rhyme, together to solve unspeakable crimes. Sleuth power is supersized for our enjoyment. The book is performed by an ensemble cast.
As a practice, Harry Bosch did his best to stay out of tunnels, but as he came out of Logan Airport, a tunnel was unavoidable. Either the Ted Williams or the Subner, take your pick. The rental car's GPS chose the Williams, so Harry drove down and deep under Boston Harbor. The traffic backed up at the bottom and then completely stopped as Bosch realized that the timing of his red-eye flight from L.A. had landed him in the heart of morning rush hour. Of course, the tunnel was much bigger and wider and was well lit in comparison to the tunnels of his past and those of his dreams. He was also not alone in his predicament. The passage was wall-to-wall with cars and trucks, a river of steel under the river of water, only one of them flowing at the moment. But a tunnel is a tunnel, and soon the chest-tightening feeling of claustrophobia took hold. Bosch started to sweat and impatiently honked the horn of his rental in impotent protest. This apparently only served to identify him as an outsider. The locals didn't honk. They did not rail against that which they could not change. Eventually, traffic started moving, and he finally emerged, lowering his window to let in the fresh air. He made a mental note to find a map and then chart a way back to the airport that did not include going through a tunnel. Too bad the car's GPS didn't have a no tunnels setting. He would have to find his way back to the airport on his own. The LAPD's Open Unsolved Units travel protocol called for Bosch to check in with the local authorities immediately upon arrival in another city. In this case, that would be the District E-13 offices of the Boston Police Department in Jamaica Plain. This was the district that included the address Bosch had for Edward Paisley, the man whose DNA Bosch had come to take, surreptitiously or not. Bosch, however, often trampled on the official cold case protocol. He usually followed his own protocol, which involved getting the lay of the land first and maybe putting an eye on his quarry, then going in to meet and greet the local constabulary. Bosch planned to check out Paisley's address, maybe get a first look at him, and then check into the room at Courtyard by Marriott he had reserved on Expedia. He might even take a short nap after check-in to make up for the lost sleep on the flight out. In the early afternoon, he would go to District E-13 and tell the captain or major in charge that he was in from L.A. on a 15-year-old cold case murder. He would then most likely be paired with a division detective who had fallen from favor with command staff. Squiring around a visiting detective following a lead on a 1990 cold case was not a choice assignment. Two nights before, at a bar on Warren Street in Roxbury, Dontell Howe had asked Patrick Kenzie, "You got kids?" Patrick half nodded, a bit confused on how to answer. "One on the way." When? Any day now. Dontell Howe smiled. He was a trim black man in his early 30s, with close-cropped dreads and clothes so crisp you could smell the starch from 2 rooms away. First? Patrick nodded. Ain't you a little old? Dontell took another dainty sip from the one brandy he allowed himself every weeknight. Weekends, he'd assured Patrick, he could drink his weight in Henny, but weeknights and Sundays he kept his limit at 1 because every morning he drove a bus full of 45 children from their homes all over the city to Dearborn Middle School in Roxbury, about 2 blocks from the bar where he'd agreed to meet Patrick after work. A little old? Patrick checked himself in the bar mirror. A little grayer, okay. A little heavier, fine. A little less on top than he would have hoped, sure, but not bad for 40. Particularly 40 years lived as hard as he'd lived his. Either that or he was bullshitting himself, which was just as likely. You don't look like you'll be auditioning for any boy bands yourself, Dontell. But I already got 2 in grade school. Time they're in college and me and the woman are kicking it somewhere in Florida, I'll be your age. Patrick chuckled and drank some beer. Dontell Howe's voice grew deeper, more somber. So no one's looking for her? Still? But she's 12, man.
We've just heard Face Off, edited by David Baldacci. Next up on the book report is The President's Pilot by Robert Gant. A year and a half into her first term as President of the United States, Libby Paulson is in a world of trouble. Her controversial agenda has placed her in a doomsday clash with a right-wing cabal led by an enigmatic Air Force general. The conspirators will stop at nothing, including assassination, to remove Libby from office. When the extremists target Air Force One, Libby's presidency and her life rest in the hands of a maverick pilot named Pete Brand, a man with whom the president shares a secret. Thomas Block narrates.
Lyle T. Bethune, Vice President of the United States, swore under his breath. His orders couldn't have been more explicit. Under no circumstances, none whatsoever, was he to be disturbed here at the guest cottage. It was Sunday morning. Bethune was tilted back in his padded leather recliner, halfway through a second Bloody Mary. A 3-log fire crackled in the fireplace. The mellow sax of Sonny Rollins wafted from the wall speakers. Bethune was alone, with the exception of his executive administrative assistant, Ms. Sally Abruzzo, who was at his feet on the Tobreeze carpet. Sally was in the process of unzipping Bethune's Calvin Klein relaxed fit jeans, and the phone was ringing. Bethune shook his head. He couldn't believe this shit. It was the yellow phone on the corner of his desk, the secure satellite link device which had no other function than to receive calls from the President of the United States. Bethune listened to the phone ring. He would ignore it. He was indisposed, taking a shower, going to church. Hell, it was Sunday. Sally had his zipper undone. The phone continued to ring. Bethune tried to think. It was almost 10 o'clock in Washington, which made it. It took him a few seconds. 5 in the afternoon in Tehran. Damn. He knew why the phone was ringing. He let it ring twice more. Abruptly, he reached over Sally's head and punched the speaker button. Good morning, Madam President. I was hoping you'd call. He heard a muffled laugh from Sally. The voice of President Libby Paulson swelled from the speaker, crisp and clear, brimming with vitality. The same voice, Bethune remembered, that dazzled the delegates on the critical third night of the convention and clinched her nomination, their nomination. The president was calling to update Bethune on the summit meeting in Tehran. It was going well enough, even though Iranian President Sadegh Husseini, beady-eyed dissembler that he was playing games. He'd just called a recess to confer with his ministers. What's there to confer about? Said Bethune. All he's got to do is sign the agreement and start cashing in. Not this guy, said the president. It's some kind of honor thing. He has to impress his ministers by haggling over every detail. Bethune wasn't surprised. The president had gone to Tehran with the most generous proposal ever offered to the Islamic Republic of Iran. The most generous part would be the lifting of the long-standing trade sanctions against Iran. All the Iranians had to do, in exchange, was formally renounce its support for Islamic Jihad and the Taliban and, while they were at it, acknowledge the right of Israel to exist as a nation. That was all. No requirement to forswear nuclear weapons development. No agreement to turn over their stash of weapons-grade enriched uranium. Like the treaty recently negotiated with North Korea, the Iranian Accord was based on little more than trust. And as Bethune had predicted, the conservative media in the U.S. were going crazy. Selling out to the devil, screamed the headline in yesterday's New York Post. Libby Paulson was being reviled on Fox and every conservative talk show. Her approval rating had dived 5 more points, deeper than G.W. Bush's worst numbers. The president asked if Bethune had caught Senator Stroud's comment on Meet the Press. Bethune didn't have an immediate answer. Sally Abruzzo had gone fishing inside his jockey shorts. Shroud, Bethune's voice was cracking. Oh, him. Don't worry. When the Iranian Accord is a done deal, Stroud will just look like another reactionary windbag. Which sounded good, but Bethune didn't believe it. Senator Kent Stroud was the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. The deal with Iran was guaranteed to send Stroud and the neo-nut coalition into a teeth-gnashing frenzy. The president was saying something about getting the Iranian agreement ratified by the Senate. Bethune had to force himself to listen. He was looking at the top of Sally's head. The breeze from the overhead fan was playing with her blonde hair. Bethune caught the scent of her perfume, a subtle, musky fragrance. He met Sally 3 weeks after the inauguration. It was a staff party, and there was no mistaking that look in her eye. She was fun and sexy, not the brightest bulb on the tree, but smart enough to be discreet. Bethune knew that she lived in Georgetown, had a husband who did something over at Treasury, no kids. He didn't want to know more. Bethune made frequent use of the guest cottage. It was inside the perimeter of the Naval Observatory and was patrolled by uniformed Secret Service agents. A team of plainclothes agents stayed just outside the door. If they were curious about what Bethune and his administrative assistant did here on Sunday mornings, it never showed in their unchanging expressions.
We've just heard The President's Pilot by Robert Gant. Working in secret, an acclaimed group of scientists have developed a radical new approach to modern medicine that could change everything we know about the human body and its limitations. But such knowledge does not come without risk. When their laboratory in Stockholm is attacked, it becomes clear someone will stop at nothing to keep this research from reaching the masses. Intrigued? Let's see what Chris Kuzneski has in store for us in The Einstein Pursuit. As details come to light, Interpol director Nick Dial realizes the bombing in Sweden has exposed a hidden collective of the world's greatest minds. What's more, this group has been operating in the shadows for more than a century. What have they learned? And why does someone want them dead? Jonathan Payne and David Jones soon find themselves drawn into the mystery. On a collision course with the man behind the massacre, the duo must follow the history of scientific discovery in their quest to stop a villain determined to use modern advances to create his vision of the future. Dick Hill narrates.
Present day, Monday, July 22nd, Stockholm, Sweden. The lab was packed with many of the brightest minds in their field, all focused on a secret project that would change mankind forever. In a matter of seconds, they would all be dead. Of course, none of them knew why they had been called to the facility in the middle of the night. Most had assumed a major breakthrough had occurred, and they had been brought in for a historic announcement that simply could not wait until morning. Instead, they had been summoned to their slaughter. The assault had started hours earlier, long before the researchers were misled. Guards had been killed. Locks had been breached. Specimens had been located and stolen. All had been done with a surgical precision the scientists might have appreciated under different circumstances. Circumstances that wouldn't lead to their deaths. Dr. Stephanie Albright was the last to arrive at the sprawling warehouse. Not because she was running late, but because she had the farthest to drive and was on the verge of exhaustion. Over the past few months, she had averaged less than 4 hours of sleep per day, a figure that included the naps she took when she was on the verge of passing out in the lab. But she never complained. Neither did the others. They knew how important their project was, and they were willing to forego food and sleep if it meant reaching their goal a little bit sooner. Tonight, they would give up more than that. They would sacrifice their lives. Albright rushed into the lobby and took the elevator to the third floor. She was so lost in her thoughts, she failed to notice the vacant guard station and the blank security monitors and all the other things that weren't quite right. Most important, she overlooked the man in the boat who had watched her every move from the calm waters of Rydarfjarden Bay. He had waited 17 minutes for Albright's arrival. It was time to finish the job. His detonator was a state-of-the-art transmitter. It was capable of igniting multiple devices from up to 1,000 meters away. Explosives had been placed throughout the warehouse near load-bearing walls and columns. His goal was to collapse the floors, one after another, with no time for escape. A smoldering coffin of steel and concrete for those trapped inside. The assassin smiled at the thought. He had killed many times before, but never so many at once. This would be his masterpiece. With the touch of a button, the charges erupted with so much force he felt it in the bay. Chunks of stone and shards of glass filled the air before crashing to the earth like hail. Columns cracked and walls crumbled as the warehouse screamed in pain. Amplified by the water, the deafening roar forced him to cover his ears, but he refused to cover his eyes. The show was just getting started. Acetone is commonly used in laboratories around the world to clean scientific instruments. Most of the time, it is stored in polyethylene plastic containers, but this particular lab was equipped with a customized delivery system that would pump the acetone throughout the building to a multitude of cleaning stations. This setup required large drums of acetone to be housed in the upper floors of the building. The assassin knew this and used it to his advantage. To cover his tracks and to prevent survivors, he had rigged the barrels of acetone to rupture from the initial force of the blast. The flammable liquid rained down on the destruction below. Within seconds, the fumes ignited and a flash fire occurred. Flames swept through the warehouse like a blistering flood, killing everyone in their wake. The heat from the blaze was so intense that bodies in evidence literally melted, like a crime scene crematorium. On most jobs, he preferred to work alone, but that wasn't the case tonight. This project was far too complex for a single cleaner, even someone with his experience. To pull this off, he needed the help of a local team. Men to do the lifting and the drilling and the grunt work. Men to do the things he didn't have time to do. Men who were expendable. He had thanked them for their service with gunfire. Then he had left them to burn with everyone else.
That was The Einstein Pursuit by Chris Kuzneski. We've all seen Brad Taylor titles in bookstores, but learning a bit about the author's background may add to your reading enjoyment. Taylor served in the Army Infantry for more than 21 years, retiring as a Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel. During his career, he held numerous infantry and Special Forces positions, including 8 years in the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment, Delta. He conducted operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other classified locations. His final assignment was as the Assistant Professor of Military Science at the Citadel in Charleston. Taylor holds a Master's of Science in Defense Analysis from the Naval Postgraduate School, with a concentration in irregular warfare. In his new military thriller, No Fortunate Son, a hostage situation places America's most powerful political elite at the mercy of its worst enemies. Veteran operator Pike Logan and partner Jennifer Cahill receive a letter from Blaisdell Consulting, the umbrella cover company for their real employer, the Task Force, a secret counterterrorist unit. The two had expected orders for their next mission. Instead, they learn they've been fired. Pike's shock and fury is redirected when their commander asks the pair for help with a personal matter.
his niece Kylie, an exchange student in England, has gone missing. It seems all task force teams are being redirected to a developing situation. A terrorist organization has targeted military relatives of key members of the U.S. government, including the vice president's son. Their seizure of hostages has thrown the government into turmoil. They face a terrible choice: cease counterterrorist operations or watch the hostages die. Henry Strozier and Rich Orlaw perform the book.
It was a place frequented by soldiers from the sprawling Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. For the most part, their target had spent his time in the sports bar, drinking sparingly and talking with friends. He'd come alone, and given his field time tomorrow, Aiden was sure he'd leave alone. Aiden turned to exit, staging for the follow, and bumped into the woman. He saw she was considerably more intoxicated than he'd thought before, swaying slightly and using the bar for support. "Hey, I thought you had left," she gave a crooked smile. "Did you come back looking for something?" "I'm sorry, no. I'm actually leaving now." Her eyes clouded in confusion, his accent struggling to find a foothold in her soaked brain. He moved past her, hearing, "Hey, are you British?" The comment drove a needle of anger deep between his eyes, causing him to squeeze them shut harshly. He whirled around and said, "No, you stupid American cow. Irish, Irish." She stumbled back at his ferocity, and he knew he'd made a mistake. Knew he'd let his hatred overcome his discipline for the mission. She would remember him for sure now. He smiled and said, "You going to be here when I get back?" Caught off guard, the liquor clouding her judgment, she said nothing, a confused grin on her face. She hesitantly nodded. He smiled again and brushed her shoulder, saying, "See you soon." The touch made her beam, but Aiden didn't notice. Behind her, he saw his target leaving the establishment. She said something he didn't catch, and he walked to the exit, waiting a beat to let the target get some distance. He dialed his partner. "Dermot, it's Aiden. Where are you?" "Already in the car. I got him in sight. You're clear to leave." Aiden speed-walked to the driver's side of their rental, sliding behind the wheel. Fiddling with a laptop, Dermot said, "Backup is on station, waiting on the beacon to lock. What did Seamus say?" "It's now or never. We miss him tonight, we pull out." Dermot's computer flashed, and he said, "Then let's get him tonight." "Where's he headed?" "That road called Skibo or Skybo or whatever." Aiden took a right on Legend Avenue, saying, "We keep following until he gives up for the night. Same plan. We take him at the apartment." They traveled through the heart of Fayetteville, passing malls and hotels, until eventually they were on a road called Morganton, the target seven cars up on the right-hand turn lane. Aiden said, "Is that Riley Road?" "Yes," Dermot's teeth flashed in the dark. "Good omen." "He's headed home. Got the backup ready." Dermot began dialing as the light turned green. Aiden crowded the car in front of him, pushing to get into the turn lane. Unconcerned before about maintaining a close distance to the target, in fact preferring to let the beacon do the work, he now needed to be in a position to assault. He heard one horn blare, saw the light go yellow, and blasted through the turn, now two cars back. Aiden saw a sign for Stewart's Creek Condominiums and felt the excitement of the hunt rise. He said, "Get ready. Get backup ready. Remember, no shooting, no harm." The target's turn signal began to blink, and Aiden's mind flashed to Belfast and the hunting of men. He felt his lip curl involuntarily, his hands crimping the steering wheel in an effort to release the adrenaline. He had to consciously remind himself that there would be no killing here. A death would be worse than counterproductive. The target pulled into the entrance for the complex, and Aiden goosed the pedal to catch up. His headlights splashed the back window, and he saw the brake lights too late. He skidded forward, punching the bumper hard enough to slam Dermot against the dash.
We've just heard No Fortunate Son by Brad Taylor. Die Again is the latest case in Tess Gerritsen's Rizzolian Isles series. In this one, Detective Jane Rizzoli is on the case of a big game hunter found dead in his apartment, alone with the body of a beautiful white snow leopard he'd recently procured for a high-profile museum in the area. Medical examiner Mara Isles connects the case to a number of seemingly unrelated deaths where the victims have all been found hanging upside down, the hallmark of a leopard's kill. Rizzoli follows the puzzling trail of clues to Botswana, where she uncovers the unsolved mystery of a deadly safari 4 years prior. When she realizes the two cases are connected, Rizzoli must track down the sole survivor of the tragic trip to discover who or what is behind the murders. Tanya Eby narrates.
"Is that a fresh print?" Elliot asks, sounding worried. "At least someone else shares my sense of alarm."
"I didn't see it here yesterday," says Richard. "The lion must have come through last night. Imagine stepping out to answer the call of nature and running into that."
He yowls and swipes a clawed hand at Elliot, who flinches away. This makes Richard and the blondes laugh, because Elliot is everyone's comic relief. The anxious American, whose pockets bulge with tissues and bug spray, sunscreen and sanitizer, allergy pills, iodine tablets, and every other possible necessity for staying alive. I don't join in their laughter. "Someone could have been killed out here," I point out. "But this is what happens on a real safari, eh?" says Sylvia brightly. "You're out in the bush with lions." "Doesn't look like a very big lion," says Vivian, leaning in to study the print. "Maybe a female, do you think?"
"Male or female, they can both kill you," says Elliot.
Sylvia gives him a playful slap. "Ooh, are you scared?"
"No. No, I just assumed that Johnny was exaggerating when he gave us that talk the first day. Stay in the jeep, stay in the tent, or you die." "If you want to play it perfectly safe, Elliot, maybe you should have gone to the zoo instead,"
Richard says, and the blondes laugh at his cutting remark. All hell, Richard, the alpha male. Just like the heroes he writes about in his novels, he's the man who takes charge and saves the day. Or thinks he is. Out here in the wild, he's really just another clueless Londoner, yet he manages to sound like an expert at staying alive. It's yet another thing that irritates me this morning, on top of the fact I'm hungry, I didn't sleep well, and now the mosquitoes have found me. Mosquitoes always find me. Whenever I step outside, it's as if they can hear their dinner bell ring, and already I'm slapping at my neck and face. Richard calls out to the African tracker,
"Clarence, come here. Look what came through camp last night."
Clarence has been sipping coffee by the campfire with Mr. and Mrs. Matsunaga. Now he ambles toward us, carrying his tin coffee cup, and crouches down to look at the footprint.
"It's fresh," says Richard, the new bush expert. "The lion must have come through just last night."
"Not a lion," says Clarence.
He squints up at us, his ebony face agleam in the morning sun.
"Leopard. How can you be so sure? It's just one paw print."
Clarence sketches the air above the print.
"You see, this is the front paw. The shape is round, like a leopard's."
He rises and scans the area.
"And it is only one animal, so this one hunts alone. Yes, this is a leopard."
Mr. Matsunaga snaps photos of the print with his giant Nikon, which has a telephoto lens that looks like something you'd launch into space. He and his wife wear identical safari jackets and khaki pants and cotton scarves with wide-brimmed hats. Down to the last detail, they are sartorially matched. In holiday spots around the world, you find couples just like them, dressed in the same outlandish prints. It makes you wonder, do they wake up one morning and think, "Let's give the world a laugh today"? As the sun lifts higher, washing out the shadows that so clearly defined the paw print, the others snap photos, racing against the brightening glare. Even Elliot pulls out his pocket camera, but I think it's simply because everyone else is doing it, and he doesn't like to be the odd man out. I'm the only one who doesn't bother to fetch my camera. Richard is taking enough photos for both of us, and he's using his Canon, the same camera National Geographic photographers use. I move into the shade, but even here, out of the sun, I feel sweat trickle from my armpits. Already the heat is building. Every day in the bush is hot.
Now you see why I tell you to stay in your tents at night,
Johnny Posthumus says.
That was Die Again by Tess Gerritsen. Readers, the term whodunit seems to have been coined in the early 1930s, but some say the detective story itself has origins as early as 429 BC, Sophocles' play, The Oedipus Rex. Ancient history aside, the sleuth and his sidekick are the stuff of literary legend. For more top titles in the genre, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.